Can you imagine? It might happen someday, Dan. Like, what's a big one? Tom Cruise, a Brad Pitt, a Tom Hanks? Tom Hanks.
Yeah, any of them.
If Tom Hanks died, we're having a podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith podcast for April 2024. I am your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I am joined for the second time in Cinema Faith history by the one, the only, Dan Baker.
Yeah, John, thanks for inviting me back on. Did you say second? I think maybe this is my third. Maybe not. Maybe I'm crazy.
It could be maybe we did one back in the day, but the most recent one was Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
Which worked out fantastic because, you know, Tim and I are not nerds. And so we really appreciated
the Or you're not wisdom, the right kind of nerds.
The right kind of nerds. You actually played the game. You brought so much like insight into it. So that was a great podcast. And I'm hoping that today might be the same thing because I think there may be some elements that of what we're going to talk about that you might be able to add that Tim and I wouldn't. So always great to have you on. Thanks for being our backup. I feel bad because like we love you, but like you're like the first person I call if Tim's not available, but I hope you don't take it the wrong way.
No, I don't mind. It's a good role. There's not a lot of pressure to be the backup, you know?
That's true. All right. Well, here we go. We're excited. So first thing I guess we should talk about is the Oscars because that happened and you were here for him. This is actually another good reason why I'm glad that you're here because I'm pretty sure, well, Tim couldn't join us for the live chat and I think he didn't even watch it because he was traveling some like fishing expedition. So I'm really glad that you're here because we can actually talk about it. So the Oscars took place. You came over to my house as you've done the last however many years. And so that was awesome. We had our annual live chat, which I'm fairly certain no one on planet Earth joined us for. So that was interesting. Listeners, just kidding.
I mean, part of this is a technology issue. There's not a great platform for live chat. You know, Reddit used to have a live chat feature. They discontinued it back in December. Maybe like Discord, but that's really more for gamers and those types of folks. I don't know. Maybe the whole idea of a live chat is just has come and gone.
But it just makes me so sad because I love the idea of like, you know, we could have a listener in Kazakhstan and he can just join us for this real time moment. I feel like we got to brainstorm and come up with something, but it wasn't good. And you texted me like, I think an hour before the show that, oh yeah, Reddit doesn't do live chatting anymore. So we were really on our game. We're going to come up with something. We'll, you know, we got a year, Dan. We got a year to figure this out. But what did you think of the ceremony itself, like the actual Oscars? What did you think of it?
So I'm not like a celebrity watcher. I don't care too much about what's going on in that world. But I mean, I pay attention to film and I like art. So I like seeing people get their due.
Yeah.
And honestly, I thought Jimmy Kimmel did great. I'm a fan of like live comedy. Mm-hmm. And so to see a comedian out there doing the whole like hosting duties. I thought he did a great job and it was funny and it wasn't mean, which is something I think a lot of those live shows have shifted to like, let's see how mean we can be to these celebrities.
Yeah. Ricky Gervais was like the worst. Like he would just pick them apart one by one. And it just kind of crossed that line where it's like, no one's feeling good about this.
Yeah. Right. So I thought that was funny.
He's good. He's really good at thinking on his feet. Like he just like even that Trump joke, you know, like Trump basically mocked him on socials and like 2 minutes later, he's just out there riffing on it. And that's because he does a live talk show every night. Right. So he's used to it.
That's a real gift as far as in the performing world. You know, not everyone can get up there and riff like that live.
So. Yeah. I love John Mulaney's Field of Dreams bit. I think that's my favorite.
Oh, yeah, that was amazing.
He's so great. No, it was good. I really thought it was a nice presentation because like it didn't feel too long. It felt like, you know, I didn't love the whole like bringing the actors out to talk about the other actors because I just prefer clips, but whatever. That's a personal preference.
To me, that was a nice touch. It made it feel more personal. Mm-hmm. You know, these are all celebrities and in whatever fan fiction that we make up about their lives, like we pretend that they all know each other. They're all buddies. They hang out and they do all these things. It's probably not really the case. So, I mean, to have actors praising other actors, that's good. That's a healthy thing. It makes it feel like it's more of a community. I don't know if it really is in real life, if they're like cutthroat competitors with each other.
That's a good point.
I mean, how mad are people that don't win? I don't know.
We'll never know.
Yeah. They have to be very composed on camera when they don't win. So.
Definitely. And as far as the winners and losers, I mean, you know, it went about as I expected. Oppenheimer won way too many awards, considering it should have won nothing. And sorry, you know how I feel about Oppenheimer. It's okay. It's fine. And then I was really rooting for Maestro because I thought that was the best movie of 2023. But I'm very much in the minority on that. The online community hates Maestro with a passion. They think it's terrible and that Bradley Cooper is just basically spent 7 years trying to win an Oscar. But I thought it was a great movie. And then freaking Al Pacino at the end. I just don't understand how hard it is to go, and the winner is, like, I mean, I just did it. I just made that up, but like, he still screwed it up. Ugh, weird. Anyway, the Oscars. So there you go. It was good. And so what happens is, as I always love this time of year, because the Oscars are sort of like, you know, it's such a weird movie season, because it's like we spend 2 or 3 months into the new year still talking about last year. And I did all the Oscar write-ups. If anyone out there hasn't read them, you can. They're on our website, cinemafaith.com. But like, this is the greatest time, because it's like we get to start fresh and we have a whole new season to look forward to. All what are we going to be talking about at the Oscars next year? It's just like, I really just love the rhythm of that. Like, you just don't know.
Yeah, we probably won't be talking about another Aquaman movie. Oh, so I mean, gosh. At least we know what we're not talking about.
You love Aquaman. You secretly love it. So, all right. Yeah. So here we are. And what's also great is that usually March is a total wasteland. Like, it's basically the dumping ground for, hey, this didn't get nominated for anything and we have no idea what to do with it. March. But this year, Dan, we actually have a movie to talk about that A, has great reviews behind it, and B, is very popular. Like, it's made a ton of money. So people might actually be interested in hearing what we have to say. It's very rare that this happens in March, but it happened, and we are here to talk about it. And that movie is Dune Part 2. That is what we're talking about today, in case you just clicked blindly and, you know, didn't read the title. So, look, it's grossed almost $400 million in the U.S., $600 million worldwide. A lot of people have seen this movie, and so I'm really excited to talk about it with you.
And it's just called Dune 2. That's it. I appreciate that there's no subtitle.
Oh, like The Way of Water or some garbage like that.
Dune 2, Desert Aquaman, something like that. I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I appreciate that too. All right. Dune 2. So look, we've already obviously seen Part 1. I saw it twice. Did you see it more than once? You saw it twice?
I saw it twice. Yep.
Okay. I liked Part 1 a lot. I was actually really surprised how much I liked it, because I wasn't familiar with the source material at all. I went in blind, and I just thought what really I liked about it, because it was my first kind of entrance into the whole world, was just how different it was from like Star Wars. And, you know, because it was just much more philosophical, and it just felt like here's a sci-fi movie that's just directly for grown-ups, just like, it's just felt like a more mature sci-fi movie than, and not saying anything against Star Wars, it's a classic, I'm just like, there's much more of like a swashbuckling adventure sort of vibe, whereas this just feels a little more like, I don't know, heady is all I can say. You know,
sure, yeah. There's no goofy bits. There's no like funny robots or, you know, weird aliens that are, you know, surprisingly funny to 20th century humans.
Cuddly Ewoks.
Nothing like that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I thought it was great. I did show it to my kids on the second viewing. My younger ones predictably didn't love it. They're like, okay. I mean, it's fine. It held their interest, but it, you know, it just doesn't have that same broad appeal that Star Wars or whatever does. But
yeah, some people would say that Star Wars was influenced by Dune, that George Lucas, quote, stole some ideas from Dune. And obviously we've got a desert planet, right? So there's one similarity.
Tatooine. It's a big part of Star Wars.
Right. There's also a Chosen One character.
Yep.
So, you know, those two things maybe, but I mean, that's a lot of movies.
Yeah. I don't know. Everyone's stealing from everyone, Dan. We just got to embrace it. You know, Tarantino said it's fine. He said it's fine. All right. So let's talk about Part 2. First, we got to talk about our theater experience. So you actually saw this before I even asked you to podcast on it. You were already all over it. So what was your, when did you see it? Who did you see it with?
Yeah. So my wife and I went to see it as a date. Mm. And so we watched Part 1 like a couple days before, just on the wall.
The wall is your project onto your wall. Right. It's fantastic. We watched 2001 A Space Odyssey on Dan's wall. Amazing.
Yeah, it was nice. So we went and saw it at one of our IMAX theaters. It's obviously, it's not like true IMAX. I believe this movie, was it shot in 70 millimeter? Am I wrong?
I don't know about the, if it was 70. There are 70 millimeter presentations of it, so it must have been. But it was shot in true IMAX, and we don't have a true IMAX theater around here, which breaks my heart. There's one in Grand Rapids that I grew up on, and it's just, it's so different than the one we have. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so we went to one of the fake IMAX, and it was funny because we get there, and it was surprisingly uncomfortable. Like, we were jammed in so tight with, and it was full. The theater was completely full. Oh. I mean, we got there a few minutes early. We got in, got seated. Like, okay, this isn't bad. Then as people started coming in, you realize how tight everything is, especially because it's Wisconsin in the winter and everyone's wearing winter coats, and some people file in behind us, and they were so mad at how uncomfortably tight it was.
Yeah.
Like, these seats do not recline. There's no heater. There's no nothing, you know, there's nothing fancy about it. You just, as many people as you can get into an IMAX theater is what you get in. Now, we had great seats. We're kind of right in the center, but yeah, the people behind us were not happy. One guy was just like, I mean, he was ready to get up and walk out before the movie even started.
So, I love it. I love whenever I'm in a mutiny situation like that. I went to a concert once, and our seats happened to be behind a big pole. Everyone just collectively freaked out. This one guy was like, I'm calling him. I'm just going to call him. And like, I just love that. Anyway, I hate that theater so much. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's the worst.
Yeah, it was bad. I didn't realize that it was going to be like that. I wouldn't have gone with the IMAX experience if I had known that it was so tight like that.
But everyone settled down eventually, and was it a good presentation visually?
Yeah, and here's the crazy thing.
Yeah.
Like, so we're sitting there, and you know, I mean, I had a soda and some popcorn, and I was like, all right, this is really, really tight. This is a long movie. I'm going to get into that, you know, halfway through the movie, and I'm going to have to go to the bathroom. I have to push past all these people. And the movie is, the pacing is so well done that, like, you don't notice that you're sitting through a 3-hour movie.
Totally.
And so, like, just every set piece pushes the whole plot forward. I feel like there's not really a lot of wasted time at all. I mean, you're just constantly getting pushed forward, and there's little mysteries getting revealed along the way. And it was just great. So, I mean, the uncomfortability of the whole situation didn't really matter.
You just, like, melted away once it started. Yeah.
Yeah, you get lost in the film. And I think a lot of that is the pacing, but I mean, the world building is just so, it's like, sucks you right in, and there's so much detail to take in on the screen. The sound was great. So, I mean, other than being tight, I would say that it was fine. I mean, I would go there again. Hopefully the place wouldn't be packed like it was for this, but but yeah, I would do it again.
All right. It just sucks that we don't have the, I don't know if you've ever been to an actual IMAX, but I mean, it's just night and day. It's like, it's supposed to be stories tall, not just a big screen. Yeah. Like, it's supposed to be a huge, like, thing. And I saw the Jaws re-release there in Grand Rapids in the true IMAX a few years ago. And it's such a great experience when you can get there. And it was shot in IMAX camera. So such a bummer.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I remember as kids, we would go to Six Flags down in the Chicago area, and they had an IMAX screen. And it would always be, for some reason in my mind, every single year we would go, it'd be the same movie, and it would just be like a bunch of footage of like a helicopter, like point of view, swooping through the Grand Canyon, and that was it, like
the Grand
over and
Canyon?
Over again.
That, I mean, that's nice once, I guess.
Yeah, no, it felt amazing. Like when you were doing it, you just couldn't believe it because, like, growing up, for one thing, I wasn't allowed to go to the movies, but once I was allowed to go, the only theater we had was, our hometown theater was like a second run films. It was literally $1 to get in.
Nice.
It leaked, like the ceiling leaked. There was mice running around on the floor.
Not nice.
It was a tiny screen because it was a converted, like, vaudeville type stage. It was just this real small stage and everything. And so getting this IMAX experience, even if you're just swooping over the Grand Canyon year after year, it was worth it.
Yeah.
So I'm still trying to recapture that.
Totally. Well, so I just, yeah, since we don't have proper IMAX, I picked the best, biggest screen I could find. It's my favorite theater, Majestic, and they have this, the Ultra screen, and they have this new thing called Cinity, which I hadn't seen before. It's supposedly the best version of lighting in 4K and dynamic, I don't know. I no idea, but that's what they're advertising on their Ultra screen. It's called Cinity. It was fine. I could not tell the difference, if I was being honest, but it seemed like a really great picture and sound. The problem, though, is I had my kids with me. Dad, I don't know why I do this to myself. Like, I really don't. I don't know if there's any other parents out there that can relate to me, but it always seems fun taking the family out. I'm always, you know, like when you want to go out to dinner, you're like, let's go out. Yeah. And you're like, we're just going to live on the town with the fam. Yeah. And then you get there and you're like, why did we do this? That's how it is in the theater every time. So we got there and they were all wanting the popcorn bucket, the worm popcorn bucket, the famous failure. But that's exclusive to AMC. You didn't even get it, and you went there.
No, I didn't. I didn't. And I got popcorn. I didn't even see the bucket.
Oh, they have the bucket, Dan.
All right.
So they didn't have it at Marcus, so the kids were bummed already on that. And then, I'm just juggling buckets and candy and drinks, and I'm like, this is so bad. My middle child, God bless him, I love him to death, he has a disability. He has an eyesight. His eyesight gets really bad in the dark. And so I thought he was behind me the whole time, and we're just settling into our seats. He's wandering around the theater, groping in the dark like I left him at the door accidentally. He has no idea where to go. So I had to go run and get him. And then the other thing about his eyesight that made it hard was I was sitting right next to him, and he would frequently lose his like M&Ms or something, and then he would spend the next 15 minutes on the hunt for this lost M&M that disappeared behind him. And it's so distracting. I'm trying to focus, and I'm like, Jonah, just eat another one. It's okay. Anyway, so I didn't love that, but at the same time, it was kind of like what you said, is like once it got going, I feel like we all melted into it, and it was at the end of the day, they loved it and I loved it, and we had a fun time out. But you know, kids.
Yeah. God. Definitely the kind of movie you don't want to watch on your phone.
No, do not watch this on your phone. Like, watch, you have to see this on the biggest screen that's near you, because it really is worth it. It really is. So let's talk about the plot. And I'm also going to like work this time in to talk about the book, because I don't think Tim has read the book. I could be wrong. I definitely have not read the book. So that's why I'm really excited to have you here, because you actually understand the source material. So can you just talk for a second about when you read the book and what your experience is with that?
Yeah. So I read there's six books in the Dune series that was written by the original author, Frank Herbert.
Okay.
So he wrote these all in like the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, probably early 70s. He died before the sixth book was published. And so his son took over and finished it based on his notes. And then his son has now continued writing Dune books, basically like in – probably he'll write Dune books until he dies.
He's still writing them, his son?
Yeah, his son is, yeah.
Wow.
And he also partners with – for those of you who are – real big science fiction reading nerds from the 90s, Kevin J. Anderson, who is famous for writing all of the different Star Wars novels from kind of back when George Lucas still owned it. And when they try to take all the novels and make them fit into like one weird canon, he wrote like the biggest, most popular Star Wars novels back in the 90s.
I did read a few of those. I wouldn't call myself a huge sci-fi nerd, but I read some Star Wars novels, Dan.
Yep. So he is now partnered up with Frank Herbert's son, and they've continued the Dune series. There's prequels and there's sequels. The original six, the first three books kind of are almost like a self-contained plot. Then it just spins off into insanity. So I would not recommend the entire series.
Okay.
It just gets weirder and weirder. I first read them when I was in high school. So I believe I was a senior in high school, and I had at least one study hall, maybe two. And so I would just go to the library and read for like as much as I could. So I always had a huge stack of books. I had a special chair that was like my chair. Mm-hmm. There's even a picture of me in my senior yearbook. And it's like the caption's like, Dan Baker sitting in his favorite reading chair.
That's nice. I don't know. I mean, it could be perceived as antisocial, but you know, it's fine. It's
fine. I mean, what else was I going to do? I was checked out, you know?
Totally.
So I was trying to catch up on like some classic sci-fi, and the thing about the 70s science fiction, to me, it's like typified by Frank Herbert, who wrote Dune, and then like Robert Heinlein, who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land and a bunch of other books. These dudes kind of typified this 70s version of sci-fi, which was less about trying to guess what the future was going to be like and more about social commentary on the present. So, you know, I mean, the best sci-fi really is social commentary, but, you know, then you have like a lot of weird fantasy type stuff that is like, well, what if we went to Mars? What would it be like?
Mm-hmm. Even 2001 a little bit still feels kind of like this is what the future might be or something like
right.
that. You're saying this is more about social commentary, Dune and all that.
Yeah, there was, yeah. I mean, obviously it's social commentary, but it's set in a bizarro setting. And so, I was interested. I read the first couple of them and then I was like, well, I may as well finish it. And it just kept getting more and more weird. The books are quite different. Denis Villeneuve.
That's it. You pronounce it right. You do not call him Dennis. I would make that mistake because I said Oppenheimer for an hour. You know me. So it's Denis. It's Denis.
Yeah. When he adapted the novel, he wanted to make some changes, and he did make some significant changes to some of the more, I would say, standard kind of 70s sci-fi tropes. One of them being like, there's a lot in 70s sci-fi about like sexual liberation. And so like the women were always, you know, they just wanted to have sex with the men. And can we just do that? And so it was like a big part of it. And
great for a repressed Christian to be reading this stuff back in the day.
Right, right. But again, like it was the early 70s. And I mean, that was mirroring what was happening in society with kind of the sexual revolution and things like that, you know, feminism and women's liberation. I think a lot of that was happening. Now, sidebar, there was not a lot of women writing science fiction at the time. So even Dune is written from a very male perspective. I mean, it has a lot of patriarchal themes in the books. Now, that's one of the things that they changed when they converted it into the film. Especially the most significant one is Chani, Zendaya's character. Mm-hmm. In the book, she's much more kind of subservient to the ideas and the power of Timothy Chalamet.
Interesting. Whereas she's a lot more independent and kind of her own person in the movies. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the ending of Dune 2 is literally the exact flips opposite of the book. In the book, she accepts her role as his concubine as he marries the emperor's daughter.
Wow.
And that's kind of how the book ends.
That in and of itself is social commentary, how different we look at things now. Yeah.
Yeah. So now, I mean, the books are really interesting and they do flesh out the world a lot more. I mean, my wife and I went and saw the movies and like I said, we saw part one twice. I mean, she still didn't get the sense. And I think they communicated it pretty poorly. What is the importance of spice on Arrakis? I mean, do you know, like, John, what would you say the importance of it is?
Well, it's very vague, Dan. I really feel like it's an important chemical that maybe gets you a little high, and that's really, everyone's having a really good time on that. And, you know, it's also very valuable. That's what I've got.
Okay. Yeah. But why is it valuable? That's the question.
People love it. People love it. Right. I don't know.
It's hugely important to the plot of the books because it's kind of it's kind of what turns the entire engine of the decisions that get made, right? So I will tell you that the point of the planet Dune or Arrakis is that these sandworms live on there, and as they zoop through the sand, they create this spice as kind of a after effect of their, I don't know if it's a waste product or whatever it is. And the spice, when ingested by humans, allows them to see and react to near future events, not in a psychic way necessarily, but in just, it unlocks the ability, and the books makes this really clear, for interstellar travel. So like a human can't fly a spaceship because of interstellar distances and moving at the speed of light and all this stuff. It's just too complicated, it's too fast, there's too many movements. But when a human ingests spice, then time essentially slows down for them and they're able to see exactly what's happening. They can almost see the future a little bit, like it has that almost that kind of effect.
Wow. I wish we had had that explanation in the movie, because like they did mention, first of all, I don't think they drew a clear connection with the fact that the spice comes from the sandworms, that that's kind of like related to them. Unless I missed it, I didn't get that. And two,
no, I don't think they
mentioned the time or that it's essential for space travel, but they didn't really mention why. Like, that makes sense. You ingest it so that you can actually see all of the variables that you couldn't as a normal. I really feel like this is a solvable problem. Like, I mean, they could have conquered this in like three sentences. I don't get it. Okay, yeah. Whatever.
So, I mean, you know, so that's why everyone wants control of this planet, because whoever has control of the spice essentially controls interstellar trade, interstellar travel, colonization of planets between the stars, and all these things. So it's incredibly important to like the economics of this future empire, which is spread across the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So
makes sense. Okay. Thank you. Wow. I bet there's some listeners whose minds are being blown right now, because, you know, that's really important information. So as far as plot is concerned, in the first one, you've got this planet, Arrakis, Dune, and the House Atreides is responsible for taking over this planet. They've been entrusted by the Emperor to come and take it over. And so they do that, but there's these evil Harkonnen people that were there first, and they left, and then a House Atreides comes in, but then the Harkonnens work out some deal with the Emperor or whatever behind the scenes, and they're allowed to come back and basically destroy House Atreides and take over the planet again. So that's what the first one is all about. In the second one, you've got Timothy Chalamet plays Paul. He's sort of like this figure that maybe is the one, some sort of messiah person or whatever, and his mom is Lady Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson. And so, and the end of the first one, they're in exile because Harkonnen have come in and destroyed most of their family, and so they're in exile with the desert people, the Furman, who know how to, you know, they communicate with the sandworms, or they're familiar with them, they can ride them and stuff. And so then in the second one, we get a lot more into the world of the Furman and sandworms. And then Paul, I won't spoil too much, even though we spoil everything here, and I think we've already made a disclaimer so many times, but Paul, you know, has to deal with his mystical potential origins and become the savior of this, the Furman people against the Harkonnens and the other houses that exist in this universe that also are in place. So that's basically the plot. And then Zendaya, we've got going on. Chani, she is the love interest, and Paul has to balance the fact that he really genuinely loves her with also what is the politically right, you know, marriage if he is able to conquer the Emperor. And so there's a lot of, yeah, it's a lot of politics, but it is still a fun movie. Like, I mean, that's interesting. It's like, it's not, it doesn't feel like you're just bored with all of, what I just said sounds boring, but it actually is very entertaining. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, John, I know you like to mispronounce things. So
yeah, thank you.
It's Fremen.
Fremen? Are you serious?
Yeah. Fremen. Fremen.
Okay. They pronounced it that way in the movie, and I just totally missed
they
it.
They did, yeah.
Oh, jeez. Yep. Sorry. Okay, Fremen.
Yeah.
Got it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, so that's the plot, and that's the book. Thank you, Dan. I mean, that was really insightful. I really appreciate that. If you had to say, would you take the book or the movie, what would you take?
I think I would take the movie for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, because the stuff that gets dropped out in the translation, it's either completely unnecessary or it's just dumb. So, I mean, and the visuals of this are just so stunning that, I mean, sometimes I resent movies for trying to get me to picture things in the books. Mm-hmm. You know, Lord of the Rings, great example. Mm-hmm. I can't read the books anymore without just picturing all the movie guys, you know? So, but for this, I think the visuals are better than what you get just reading the books. So,
okay.
Love it for that.
There you go. Awesome. Let's move into acting. There are so many great actors in both movies. It really is stunning, like just how many awesome actors Denis was able to compile for this film. We can only get to really a few of them, and we're going to be talking about it all day. But let's start with Timothy Chalamet as Paul, the man of the hour. I think he's perfect. Like, I mean, what more do you want from a casting decision than this? He's got the wavy hair. He's boyish, but also like you buy him as a bit of a manly warrior guy. Like, they killed it with that decision. What do you think? Timothy Chalamet as Paul. Yeah.
Yeah. He's perfect for the role. you know, you've got someone young enough that they kind of have this inexperience and maybe a little bit of naivety, but they're kind of right at that edge of adulthood. I think that Chalamet plays that perfectly.
Yep.
And who knows? I mean, maybe he's like a Peter Pan type of guy and he's going to be able to play that edge forever.
Could be.
Because, I mean, have you seen him play like a man in anything?
No, I don't know. How long can he get away with it? Exactly. My first experience with him where I really took notice was Call Me By Your Name, where he played against the canceled Armie Hammer. And he was so good in that. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, that his boyishness was absolutely essential to the plot of that. I wonder how long he can keep going. But he's great. Chalamet's great. I'm excited to see what he does with his career. He's just a really good actor, and he's just really taken off. He did Wonka, which I have not seen, so I don't know about that. But he's currently filming a movie about Bob Dylan. He is going to play like the 70s era Bob Dylan, and I've seen some set photos, and he looks perfect as Dylan. And so I'm excited about that. And he's not boyish, I wouldn't say. So we'll see. We'll see. Yeah.
Okay.
So there you go. Zendaya, I don't know if it's Zendaya or Zendaya. This one we're gonna have to pick one. I'm gonna say Zendaya. I think that's right, but I could be wrong.
I think that's right.
Okay, so she plays Paul's love interest, Chani. It sounded like Johnny to me in the movie, but I don't know. They were a little loose with that. Chani makes sense. It's spelled Chani. So
it's spelled Chani. Yeah.
This is a whole podcast about pronunciation. That's really what this all is. It's fine. If you want to see her, what she is capable of doing, you should go watch Euphoria because that's her show. She's the lead in it. She's been nominated for everything for that. She's so good in that show. But this is okay. I just think she doesn't have a ton to do as far as like acting. She's great. She's great in the role. Like there's nothing wrong with what she did.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was a lot about the physicality of the actors that was really important. And, you know, for Zendaya, who has kind of an ethnically ambiguous look, it was important for the Fremen characters. I mean, those characters are, generally speaking, not white people. I mean, at least in this film.
Yeah.
So I think that was really important for her character. Yeah, you're right. She didn't have a whole lot to do. You know, there's some emotion, I guess, at some points, but
she played her character exactly like it needed to be played. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rebecca Ferguson played Lady Jessica. That's Paul's mom. I liked her a lot. She had a lot to do because she kind of becomes this, what did they call it? The Reverend Mother? Is that what it, that's what it is, right?
Yeah. Mother Superior, maybe? Something Reverend like Mother? That. Yeah. One of those.
I liked that transition. And I love the whole mystical, the way they just handled the mystical elements in the movie because it was very visual and like the voice, you know, and just it was very gripping. And I liked her transformation and I thought she was great. I first noticed her in, honestly, it was Mission Impossible, I think, was the first time I really like just saw her. It was Rogue Nation, maybe. But she's made a career for herself, and I thought she was really good in this.
Yeah, I agree. I think that her transition from, you know, the wife of the Duke to, you know, the Reverend Mother, there was a scene where she had the choice, right? She had to make that choice. Am I going to become this thing? And, you know, it was essentially going to kill her to become this.
Yep.
Or, you know, close to it. And so then she had to kind of go through this ritual that was extremely painful and essentially was reborn. And I mean, her character changed significantly between those two characters. So I think that was a great kind of, from an acting perspective, she did a great job selling that. Now, every once in a while, she would come back and talk to just her son. Mm-hmm. And then you could kind of tell she's still like his mother. She's still the same kind of person. But she has this other persona now that's public, that's really powerful, that's very mysterious, that people are essentially kind of enthralled by her.
Yeah, she has like one foot in reality and one foot kind of in the spiritual realm, really, for the rest of it. Yeah.
And her costumes were amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the costumes throughout this whole thing were unbelievable. But like all those religious figures, right? The Bene Gesserit, I think they're called.
Yeah.
They had these like overblown kind of mixture of like, I don't know, like Orthodox and or heavily Catholic kind of ritual clothing.
Exactly.
Mixed with maybe Islamic type clothing. And it was just a great mixture of different religion that we're familiar with to try to build this ultimate like powerful religious force that is like sowing all these weird, mysterious kind of seeds across the universe trying to do whatever their big plan is.
I loved it too. I know. I've from the costumes to the weaponry, the helicopters, it was like everything was weird in a fascinating way, and it also felt grounded in a way that we can still understand. Like, gosh, they did a great job with all that.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between the different houses, right? So really, we only saw like the two main houses, right? We saw Atreides and the Harkonnen, but like the visual difference that they built between these two cultures. And I mean, you would really get the sense that if you weren't just part of a country, but you were part of an entire planet that was one empire, you know, like what would that do for the aesthetic of your planet?
That's a good point.
You know? So, I mean, you had all these different things. You had this, you know, the Atreides, who were some kind of weird, almost like Greek or Roman type of classical. They had that look about them, right? On their home planet.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they moved to Arrakis, everything got all washed out because it's just desert planet. But then the Harkonnens had these weird, everything's like black and white and just really stark and almost, I mean, literally it was like a horror movie. That scene, all the scenes on their planet was like a horror movie.
So good.
Just visually, like kind of differentiating between these different cultures. And I mean, it was just so, yeah, it was beautiful.
Totally. Let's talk about the most famous Harkonnen from part two, which is Austin Butler plays this, the villain, the main villain of the movie, Fyad Rotha Harkonnen, maybe something like that. So
that sounds right.
Look, he's great. I like him a lot. I thought he should have won an Oscar for Elvis. I think him in the minority because everyone I've talked to is like, oh yeah, everyone can do Elvis. But I thought he was a great Elvis and he should have won an Oscar for it. Gosh, what does a guy have to do anymore? He would freaking killed that movie. Anyway. I like Austin Butler, and I thought he was so creepy in this movie. He's just like bald and snake-like and psychopath. That's what you want in a villain. This guy wants to kill people, and he wants all the glory, and he's just got to be taught a lesson, Dan. That's a classic villain right there. Loved it.
Yeah, and the fact that they were all essentially psychotic, right? So, I mean, you had, you know, the Baron, who was like a psychotic kind of... Again, he's a horror movie figure. They're all human, but they're all like human in almost extreme ways, right? And then you had What's-His-Face from the Guardians of the Galaxy. You know him. You love him. What? Dave Bautista.
Oh, Bautista. Yeah, for sure.
He was one of the Harkonnen cousins.
Yep.
And, you know, again, they're human, but they're like extreme human. And they have like these weird, I mean, I don't know if it's clear, if they have like body modifications or... You know, I mean, obviously like the baldness and the white skin and everything is just, yeah, just creepy stuff. I thought Austin Butler did a great job. Yeah, he was creepy. He didn't have an Elvis accent. That was nice.
I know. He just became synonymous with the role. Like, because it was weird. He was a child actor. And I mean, he like grew up on iCarly and, you know, that whole like realm.
Oh,
and,
really? So yeah. I don't know his backstory at
totally.
All.
Totally. And, but like, I just feel like there's probably people who followed his whole career since he was a kid, but most of us really just saw him kind of burst on the scene out of nowhere with Elvis. And all we heard was that Elvis accent. So I totally get what you're saying. Cause I feel like he gets ribbed all the time. It's like, do you just talk like that all the time? Because he just immersed himself in that role. But no, it was nice seeing some variety. The guy's got chops.
Yeah, he was creepy and he was evil. But then there was like little flashes of like, is he kind of also being manipulated into whatever role like the powerful want him to serve?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was just weird. Even the scene I thought was just, it was wonderful, but again, kind of a horror movie scene where they're doing this performative kind of gladiator spectacle.
Yeah.
So where he has to fight all these guys.
Yep.
And they're all drugged so that he can just defeat them right away. And then there's like these weird demon-y guys in the background. I don't know. But
yeah.
But even that scene, like you get a little sense of like empathy for this person, like, you know, because he's crazy, clearly, and he wants to kill because he enjoys killing. But also, like, he wants to please his uncle. Like, he wants to prove himself as, like, you know, I'm actually worth something.
And he's a pawn in everyone's game, it feels like, you know?
Right. So I thought, I mean, as an actor, like, to pull that off, that's good stuff. Because he could have just been a cartoon, but I think he was more than that.
Yeah. This is what happens when you have a director who's capable of bringing and inspiring a bunch of legitimately great actors. I mean, exactly. You could do this in any movie, but I mean, this one especially, like, you could have a very generic version of this film with actors who are not as good, and it would be terrible. This is why they get paid with, well, let's not talk about that. They should not be getting paid millions of dollars. But the point is that this is why you get those people, is because they're going to bring that intangible element that a lesser actor just can't, like the three-dimensional element to it. And you're right. Absolutely. It could have been so many of these could have been caricatures, and instead they're believable and they have nuance and they're not just one thing. They're multiple things. Great acting all around. And it's so fun because you don't think of sci-fi movies as having great acting, but it did. It just really did.
Yeah, totally.
Let's talk about the man who brought this all together. Let's talk about Denis Villeneuve. Not Dennis, Dan. It's not Dennis.
No, not Dennis.
Gosh. So I realized that the first movie I saw of his was Prisoners. I actually saw that movie in the theater. It was Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal. It wasn't like the best movie ever, but it was good. Mm. I remember that, and I forgot that he had directed that. But what really put him on the map, of course, was Arrival. That was the one that everyone was talking about. I don't remember. I should know this. Was it actually nominated for Oscars? I think it was. Fairly certain it was. It might have even been like one of those sneak best picture contenders. It was just, there was something, I think so. And the box office, it was one of those things that, like, just, it was this kind of sleeper thing that was supposed to go under the radar, but it just took off culturally, and it was nominated for a bunch of stuff.
That's one of my favorite science fiction films. I love that movie.
I think it's a little overrated. I know, hot take, here we go, let's bring some spice. I think Arrival is, and this is the problem I have with all of his movies, Dan, I'm gonna be honest, is that I think they're so visually impressive, they're so intellectually stimulating, but there's an emotional element that's lacking. Like, I never feel stirred in my heart. That is what I think was the major thing missing in Arrival. But we can table that. I think it's a very impressive film. I get why everyone loves it. It didn't blow me over. But then he also went on to direct Sicario, which is interesting because I love that movie. I have a review of that on the website if anyone cares. But, like, it's really good. Benicio del Toro's in that. And that is he's not just a sci-fi guy, is really why I bring that up, because, like, he can do other genres, and he really did an impressive job with that film. Yeah. So if you want to see something that's not sci-fi, check out Sicario. Did you ever watch that?
I don't think I've ever seen Sicario.
Really good. It's about drugs and, drugs.
Yeah.
But, yeah, really good. And then he did Blade Runner, 2049, and Dune. So you get why he became known as the sci-fi guy, but he has range and very good director.
I mean, I loved Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah. We saw that in the theater together. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a great movie. And you get a sense of his style. Mm-hmm. Even if you just took Arrival and Blade Runner and Dune as, like, his sci-fi grouping, I mean, stylistically, you can tell it's the same director across those films.
Definitely.
And his cinematographers.
Ugh.
I mean, I don't know how that, I don't see, this is one thing about filmmaking that I'm still not entirely clear on, is, like, how much of the aesthetic is driven by the director? How much of it is driven by the cinematographer?
Well, Dan, let me drop some film school knowledge on you. I'm just kidding.
Please do.
I've got fairly nothing. What I do remember, one of the big things I highlighted in my notes, Dan, is that the director and the director of photography, often referred to as the DP in film world, they work side by side on the film set. It's basically like a joint effort from the beginning. So
who's the cinematographer? Is that the DP, or is that a different person?
That is the director of photography, is the cinematographer. And so they just work side by side. So I think really the answer to your question is that it's impossible to tell the difference. I think they're just on the same page from minute one about how visually they want the thing to look, and then they're just together all the time. So is it him? Okay. Is it the other? I think it is the director. It's the director's vision, because the cinematographer on Dune is Greg Fraser. This guy is awesome. He's done so many things. Yeah. Rogue One, you love Rogue One. Creator.
Rogue One.
You know, so I mean, the cinematographer will go to another movie from another director, and he'll do a totally different style based on that director's vision. So it is the director, but they're on the same page, and they're just working side by side throughout the whole thing. So Love the cinematography in this. Absolutely. I think the Colosseum scene with the Harkonnens and stuff was so visually stunning. And seeing that in the theater, just like, it was truly one of the best like visual things I've ever seen in a theater. There's just something about it that was very special.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm kind of a CGI skeptic because, you know, these giant, especially when you look at the Marvel films, these giant set pieces that are like 99.9% CGI when you might even not even have a real actor on the set.
Yep.
They look ridiculous, even though, you know, they're pouring millions of dollars into every second of these shots. You know, the last Doctor Strange comes to mind immediately.
The last Guardians of the Galaxy comes to mind. You know, they're like on this alien planet and there's like some yellow goo that's splashing. It's so tiresome, Dan. I'm with you. Give us practical effects. And this feels drenched in practical effects. Yes.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And to hear about like the lengths that Villeneuve went through to shoot in the desert. I mean, he brought a crew. I mean, their crew is not just like 75 people.
No.
And some of these, he had hundreds of extras. So, I mean, you're talking about, he said that his crew at one point was 800 people that they had to bring out to the middle of the desert. They had to build roads in order to get all the equipment out there.
Yeah.
The roads had to be eco-friendly. So the roads had to be able to be taken down when they were done using them because they literally shot in the middle of the desert. There's no way to get out there. You got to fly out there. You got to have these roads set up. You have to have sidewalks built.
Wow.
Because he wanted it to feel like you are on an isolated desert planet. And, you know, some of those desert set pieces were just stunning. I mean, you look on the big screen. This is why you have to see it on the big screen.
Yeah.
Because it's just beautiful to see. I mean, a rock in the desert, when you just say it, it doesn't sound like much. But when you've got, you know, all this stuff going on and this looming, you know, physical thing that's actually there that they're actually interacting with, you know, it makes a huge difference.
It's breathtaking. Yeah. It really is. It's like your camera to the Grand Canyon. It actually feels like authentic. And that's crazy. I didn't know that. Bringing cameras... I'm not a technology expert, but bringing technology into the desert, that sounds awful. I can't believe it. I mean, I guess I knew instinctively they were probably in a real desert, but I mean, just the extent that he went to. And there's so many people that worked on this film. Go on the IMDb page and just see the cast and the crew, I mean. Like, there's so all these little mini teams and stuff. The fact that this one person could bring this just organized chaos into this amazing 3-hour movie. Like if you're talking about best director, like I know it's early, but come on.
Oh, for sure.
Jeez.
If he's not nominated for this, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah. This is a classic case of what a director is all about. It's basically, he's the ringleader of 800. You said extras, 800 was the
800. Cast and crew on like one of these desert sets.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And he does talk about in some of his interviews, you know, he originally read Dune when he was around 13. And he said that he started storyboarding Dune when he was 13. And he said he still has the hand-drawn storyboards because he wanted to be a filmmaker from when he was like in eighth grade. He wanted to be a filmmaker.
I love that.
And so he wanted to do Dune. That was his kind of ultimate prize, was to be able to shoot his own version of Dune. And it wasn't until like nobody would let him do it. He wanted to do it real early on, but people were just like, it's impossible. You don't have enough experience. You know, you're not going to be able to get the right actors, whatever. So it wasn't until he had a lot of successes under his belt that they actually agreed to give him the money to shoot a two-part, you know, what some people would call an unfilmable, you know, science fiction epic, then just knocked it out of the park.
That could have been a disaster. I mean, you hear horror stories of these things going wrong in the wrong hands. This could have been just an absolute disaster. But I mean, the fact that he was able to make Blade Runner 2049, a huge franchise pick that had a huge budget, I mean, that was a good, good calling card for him to be like, guys, I can do this. Yeah, that's great. Yep. He got to live his dream, his childhood dream. Wow. Love that.
Yeah, love it. I mean, the cinematographer on this, you mentioned Greg Fraser. I mean, the fact that he's worked with some of my favorite directors, I mean, you know, Villeneuve, but also, you know, he worked with Matt Reeves a couple times. He worked with, you know, Gareth Edwards, who did Rogue One, and Catherine Bigelow, on Zero Dark Thirty.
Zero Dark Thirty, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's like, I mean, I don't know the guy's whole backstory, but these are like some of the top directors working right now.
Totally.
I mean, these are directors that I would go see a movie if I saw that Matt Reeves was directing it. I would just go see it.
Yep. And the music, Hans Zimmer, he's back. Yes. He's back. We always, like, I feel like Hans Zimmer has become a punchline because of his work with Nolan, and everyone just sort of like, boom, that's Hans Zimmer. But dude, he was great. I love the music in this movie because it really did add a very important element. It wasn't too much as it was in some cases with Nolan's films, but it was the right amount of like, hey, this is important. This is epic. This is a universe. It had that feeling. It conjured that up without being over the top. I thought Hans Zimmer did great as well.
Yeah. I mean, I know people that listen to the soundtrack just like as, you know, working music or background music. They've never seen the movie. They're not interested in the movie at all, but wow. The soundtrack is just so powerful that it's just worth listening to.
That's awesome. Yeah, it is. It is. So bravo to everyone involved in this and Denny for bringing it all together. Man, awesome. So we got to get into themes, Dan. We've got to get into some themes. Yeah. We've talked so much. All right. What was a major theme that stood out to you in this film?
So I'll just do with one theme. I'll start with one theme.
Okay.
The big one that I think was just this idea of religion as a force that is manipulating political power.
Ah. Right?
So it's kind of the mixture of religion and politics. And again, that makes it sound boring, but
very relevant.
Yeah, super relevant. And, you know, Denis, he's French Canadian, so he grew up in Quebec. And Quebec was a Catholic city. Like, it literally was a Catholic city state almost until the 1960s.
I didn't know.
So, like, the church ran everything. And he was born in the early 70s, I think mid 70s. And so the world that he grew up in was very much this kind of world that was just shaking free of the rule of the Catholic Church over every aspect of everyone's lives. So, you know, I mean, this is a story that you can tell even the original author, Frank Herbert. I mean, he definitely had a bone to pick with Catholicism. I mean, the Bene Gesserit, you know, kind of rhymes with Jesuit. And you've got this whole like colonial power thing going where the church is kind of at the tip of the spear, if you will, trying to colonize other worlds. You know, I mean, if you look at our history, the Catholic Church was pivotal in colonizing the New World. I mean, with Spain and the Jesuits especially, they moved in, they took over these indigenous cultures, they tried to get them to convert or die, basically, and they tried to rule them. None of that really worked out. Catholicism doesn't have the power that people thought that it would have, even in the, you know, 1500s. But this is like a major theme here, right? So you've got this secret religious sect who's kind of driving this Messiah myth into this indigenous culture, and they're basically trying to push for power. So they want to be able to rule, and, you know, their ultimate goal, I think, by the end of this film is met, right? You have Paul, who is the end result of generations of a breeding program, essentially, to create this Messiah figure mixed with a Messiah mythology that they've planted in this indigenous culture. These people are fanatical over waiting for this character to come in and to liberate them. So all the pieces kind of fall into place. He does become the emperor by the end of the universe, essentially.
Right.
Or the king of the cosmos, if you want to put it in Christian terms, the Lord of the cosmos. Yeah, very kind of overt religious and political story that's being told here.
Yeah. So how does that relate to 2024, Dan? How are we? I want to get you in trouble. I know. No, let's just say, look, there does seem to be similar things going on with a very powerful force in America, which is, you know, sort of Christianity, a certain type of Christianity, mingling with power to kind of get what they've always wanted, which is sort of like power over, you know, the state. And like, you know, if you think about abortion, you think about, you know, Trump and his rise and everything. Look, we're not going to spell it out for you, and you draw your own conclusions.
You've already spelled it out.
There does seem to be some similarities.
Well, I mean, again, like historically, America is an anomaly in that we have a separation of church and state, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in Europe, if we just look at Europe, because we're two white people, all the European countries, church and state, were one, mm-hmm. right? So back in the colonial times, or back in the so-called age of exploration, every nation state, its head of state was also the head of the church, right? So you had Catholic France, and you had Catholic Spain, and you had, you know, Lutheran Germany, and you had Anglican England, and they were all sending their missionaries and their people to different places. And wherever they went, they would spread their gospel. And, you know, I do believe that the real gospel was in there somewhere, right?
Yeah.
But I also believe that there was a lot of false gospel being spread. And again, being spread at the, you know, on the point of a spear. And I mean, to the point where, you know, the American Empire was built on, you know, blood, you know, it was built in the blood of indigenous people and of African people.
Absolutely. It's indisputable.
Right. And all of that through the lens of kind of religious conversion, or, you know, the whole idea of manifest destiny, like, you know, God wants us to take this land from the pagans or from the heathens. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of the story of humanity, right? Yeah. I mean, every culture has their mythologies that they use to hold on to power. We just happen to combine ours with technology that can wipe out an entire civilization, mm-hmm. you know, without much effort.
And we happen to do it with a religion that is supposed to be, at its heart, separate from power and subverting yeah. power. If you look at the Gospels, like, we are not actually, Jesus was very specific, we're not supposed to be aligning ourselves with the Roman Empire. We're supposed to be doing something different.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is something that you and I talk about a lot.
All the time.
But I mean, it always kills me to see all these Christians, you know, pledging allegiance to the flag. Yeah. And I'm just like, can you imagine Jesus standing up in Rome and pledging allegiance to the emperor of Rome with a hand sign or a chant? I mean, it's inconceivable. Mm. The thing is that the Bible does use kingdom as a metaphor, right? And actually that word can be just as easily translated empire, but it's a different kind of kingdom. You know, it's a kingdom where the king is the servant of all. And it's a kingdom where the king shows his power by giving up all power. I mean, all power in the kingdom of God is directed downwards towards the powerless to lift them up. And so, you know, when you look at the kingdoms of this world and how they've interpreted that, they use religion as a really handy tool to manipulate people.
Absolutely.
I know it's a logical fallacy, you know, to point out, well, they're not really, those aren't the real Christians doing that, you know. I mean, that's what you want to say. You want to say that there's real Christians out there. It's just not them. Mm-hmm. It's just not the people who are saying that they're Christian. But at some point, you kind of have to take people at their word. I mean, I'm sure Columbus believed that he was doing the will. I mean, he did. He wrote about it all the time in his journals.
And that's the thing.
He believed he was doing the will of God.
Absolutely. I agree. I don't think that there are people that the people that are doing this are like, I think they really believe it. They're true believers in what they really believe, that they're doing what God wants them to do. I don't think that they're secretly going, I want to support something evil. So it's hard. I think the personification of what you just said is like, you got this guy, Donald Trump, and he's selling Bibles, Dan. He 2 weeks ago, he's literally selling Bibles, and it's actually says on the website, the only Bible endorsed by Donald Trump, and it actually comes with the Constitution or something. I mean, I'm sorry, but yeah. Like, there's a point where it's just like, what is happening? And he, by the way, he's doing that to get money for his bond money, because he's... It's a little too much. Anyway, we digress, but it's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Major theme, though.
Major theme. Yeah. Super major theme. Another theme that struck out to me, what really is just like, is how so many of the themes that you see in Dune come up again and again in these sci-fi and fantasy movies over and over, and they all point back to, I think, the original story, like the ultimate story. So, like, you talk about this idea of the One, right? You see this so much in The Matrix and this and Star Wars and even a little in Lord of the Rings, and these prophecies are foretelling the one who's going to come and save us, right? Where does that come from? I feel like that is the Christ story. Like, we have this built-in desire for an individual to come and just save us from ourselves, to save us from what we've devolved into. I think that's so fascinating that this theme keeps coming up.
Yeah. I mean, it's not super surprising because, I mean, these are all these films and stories in the modern age are being told by people who are Christianized. I would say Christianized, not Christian. People who are exposed to the Christian story. I mean, it's just part of the air that we breathe. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah, you go back, go back centuries, go back 1,000 years when fiction first started being written, like these stories, whatever they were. Yeah, you've got these constant references back to, you know, to Christian elements. And I think a lot of that was originally just like allegories, right? If you look at the original kind of novels and things like that, mm-hmm. they're very heavily and really cheesy kind of allegories back to the Bible stories.
Well, Narnia, you know, I mean, there would be one of the most famous examples. And then I just recently learned that Lord of the Rings was intentionally, by Tolkien, supposed to be Christian allegory, and we know that because he wrote a letter to a friend saying that point blank, that he made a Christian allegory, basically. But he didn't want that to be public knowledge as compared to Lewis.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of Christian themes. I don't know if I'd call it allegory.
Or not allegory, yeah. But that could be the wrong word. But the point is that he intentionally was making like a Christian something, like Tolkien. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's all there.
And the mystical elements, you see that in the Matrix where, you know, Neo's able to like overcome like the physical elements of this world. You see Star Wars, they're tapping into the Force. In Dune, there's the voice. There's always this like mystical element where it's like there is something beyond what we can see and touch, and we can tap into that. That goes back to the ultimate story. And even sacrifice, just the idea that you see again and again in these films of like you have to sometimes, you know, put aside what you really want for the greater good. Paul really probably wanted to just live an amazing life in the desert, riding sandworms with Chani, but like he's got to save the world, basically, you know? And you see it with Neo and everybody, and that goes back to the idea of sacrifice of like sometimes you have to give up. But also, like, I always fall into that trap because, like, Tim and I have talked about this all the time where it's like, I'm always like, oh, what you really want, you have to sacrifice for it. But it's not actually that. Tim always reminds me, no, it's actually about just deepening your wants. Like, what we really want is that. We actually really want to pursue something higher than just, you know, eating Alfredo and watching films all day, which is what I would want to do on a Saturday. But even there's nothing wrong with that. But there's something deeper, and that actually is more fulfilling in the end. So it's not just about like, I got to not do this thing so I can do the thing I don't want to do. I think that's a false way to look at it. But anyway, all these amazing mystical themes that show up again and again, which I think point back to the ultimate Christ story. And it's amazing.
Even resurrection, right? I mean, he had to drink the worm juice and then essentially die and be brought back in order to fulfill his calling.
Just saying. The greatest story ever told.
The one thing that, again, like in the book, it's, I think, more clear. He is a Messiah figure, but he's not a hero. He's not a heroic Messiah figure. He's more of a, I don't know if I'd call him an anti-hero exactly, because it's not until the very end that he kind of shows his true face, right? The one scene that I felt like was just maybe not, didn't have enough backbone to it, didn't have enough kind of supporting it, was the scene where he steps into the light and becomes, you know, Muad'Dib or whatever his Messiah name is. He's got a bunch of different names in the film, but it's the scene where they're in this cave and there's thousands and thousands of Fremen are all kind of bowing, and he walks in and he starts talking to people, and he grabs a guy out of the audience and he's like, you know, your grandma was this and that, and he knew these other things. And that's when he kind of reveals himself to be this figure that he didn't believe in. He knew was false, but he realized that he has to take on this persona in order to get the future that is the least bad future. I mean, that's the other thing that this is dealing with, is like fate, right? The idea of fate. And he sees this future. He sees many futures, right? But one of the futures he sees is a destruction of everyone and everything. So that's one future he sees. But then he sees another future where just a lot of things get destroyed. And so he decides to choose that future as the least worst option, right? Mm-hmm. But in order for that least worst option to happen, he has to embrace this mythology with him at the center as the Messiah.
But ironically, then he becomes the Messiah. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's a paradox,
right?
Because like this thing was made up from the start, but then he becomes it. It's sort of like Neo, the Oracle tells him point, but you're not the one, but then he just becomes the one, right? Anyway, I don't know. There is something to that.
Yeah. That's interesting. I always thought that part was weird in the Matrix. I thought they were trying to be just a little too tricksy for everyone's good, but maybe not. But yeah, that scene I thought was a little weird. It played a little weird. But again, like you can see, the camera goes to Chani as she's seeing him for the first time, like taking on the mantle of this character. Camera goes to Stilgar and he's like barely containing himself. He's so excited that the Messiah is finally revealed. And then, you know, you get to his knife fight at the end with Fayed. He goes through that whole ritual and then suddenly, spoilers, announces that he's going to marry Florence Pugh.
Yeah.
That kind of comes out of nowhere and it's like a huge shock to Chani.
Chani didn't get the email. Tough.
Right. And so, you know, in some sense, you see the beginning of him essentially setting aside his own, whoever he was at one point, right? Just Paul Atreides, the son, the loyal son. He sets that aside and he becomes this messianic character with the power to, you know, slaughter billions. Oof. And he decides to just step into that because it's the least worst choice. I don't know if he's exactly a messiah in the same sense as like Neo, who's literally is saving everyone. Mm-hmm.
And of course, he uses violence, which is
right. Well, that's yeah.
But that, because that's a given with when it comes to these.
No one's ever going to make a movie.
I know.
Where there's no, you know, epic battle.
I know. But yeah, that's a good point. These themes again and again. I love it, Dan. We got to wrap this thing up. I'm sorry.
All right,
we could talk for so long. All right, big question to leave you with. What are your final thoughts on Dune 2 and your letter grade? And where do you think this fits in with like some of the classics of the genre? Like, do you think it's like on par, better, worse? What?
I mean, I don't know if I don't have much to add. I'm going to say final thoughts. It's visually beautiful. If you appreciate great art direction, cinematography, it's worth seeing just for that. I think that the complexity of the story is worth it. So if you're a big story person, got to see it for that. Honestly, it's like everything that needs to be done right is done right here. Mm-hmm. So I would highly recommend it. I'm going to give it an A. And I'm going to say that I don't know if it's quite as I've read some reviews where some people literally say like for them, it was a religious experience or whatever because of like just so many different elements and themes and other things like that. And because of how massive the film is, I wouldn't put it on that level. I mean, I think it's going to stand the test if he never makes the third film. So he is talking about doing a third film as like the Dune trilogy. If he never makes the third film, I think these two together will stand the test of time as like great science fiction from the 2000s, the 2020s, maybe.
Yeah.
I think people are going to be watching them for, you know, for decades.
Totally agree. Yeah, I love this movie too. I think it will definitely stand the test of time. And you have to see this on the biggest screen possible. See it in true IMAX if you can, or at least just you have to see this in theater, guys. This is an experience that like you can't stress it enough. And look, I'm going to ultimately give it an A-. The reason is it goes back to all of my problems with Villeneuve's movies is there was not one time in neither one or two where I felt like I just like was stirred inside emotionally, like my heart. And I need that in order for it to be a perfect grade A film. When I watch Lord of the Rings every year, you know, freaking Sam carrying Frodo up Mount Doom and them talking about the Shire, I'm bawling every time. Like, I'm not saying I have to cry, but I have to be stirred in that way for a true, true greatness. My son walked out of this movie. He was kind of like what you were talking about. He is like, his life was changed. He was like, that was probably the best movie I've ever seen. That was better than, he's like, I know this is controversial, but it's better than Star Wars, better than Lord of the Rings. I was like, okay. Like, and that's great. He's like 16 years old. This is probably going to be a movie that he remembers as being a defining theater experience for him. And I love that for him. Because, like, you know, you and me, we got Jurassic Park. We got our moments where we were like, this changed everything for us mentally. And that was like that for him. Now, I just can't go there. I think it is not on par with Star Wars, with Lord of the Rings. But it is there. It's in the ballpark. It's an A-. It's a very good film. Very good. And so much to love here. And it will stand the test of time. I really do hope they make a third one. I think they said they're almost done with the script. And Villeneuve is getting excited about it again. And I just think a trilogy would really seal the deal on this one. But anyway, so good. I think this is going to be up for Oscars. It's so weird to talk about this. We're in March, April. But like, I really think this is going to be on my top 10 list at the end of the year. And it's going to be up for a slew of Oscars. How about that?
For sure. Yes, I think probably every technical category this will be nominated for. Absolutely. For sure.
Yeah. All right, Dan, that does it. That's Dune Part 2. It is still playing in a theater near you. You could see this tomorrow. I keep saying guys. I feel like guys is gone out of fashion. I don't know why that's in my vocabulary. Guys and girls, all people, everyone, go see this movie. It's so good.
You're supposed to say y'all.
Y'all. Is that what it is? Y'all. I got to make this transition in my mind. I do not mean to be so masculine with my terminology. I apologize. But yes, go see this movie in the theater. It's still playing. And yeah, here's hoping they make number 3. Dan, so good. Thank you for coming and being with us again today. You always do this. You always bring this missing element that I really, especially for these nerdy sci-fi movies, and that is no way denigrating to you. It is you really bring this ingredient that I don't think Tim and I would have if we had done this podcast. So seriously, thank you for doing this.
That missing element is called the fifth element, by the way.
The fifth element, yeah. Starring Bruce Willis. We will be back in May. If all goes according to plan, Tim will also be back for all you Nelson heads out there. And but Dan will be back too, because we know that Tim's going to go to Paris again or something, and we will have to get Dan back because we all love him. And he's the one and only Dan Baker, and there's no one else.
What's on the docket for May?
Great question. Do you have any idea? I have no clue, Dan. I have not looked it up. I don't know. We will find something. We will find something. But we'll be back. And thank you, Dan. Thank you, listeners, for having us back for a fresh season. This is it. This is 2024. We're in it. And Dune is at the top of our top 10 list. I haven't updated the site yet, but I will soon. Dune will be at the top, and it'll be a running list all year of the best movies. And so it's just so exciting to start over again. So there you have it. All right. We'll see you guys in May. Until then, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.